This is episode 67 of Extraordinary Women Radio. Welcome to Extraordinary Women Radio. I am your host, Cami Gilner. Women are being called to lead with voice, vitality, and vigor. Each week, join me for wisdom-filled interviews with extraordinary women living out loud and making a difference in our world. Their stories will uplift, inspire, and spark your own purpose-driven journey. Hello, my extraordinary women friends. Are you starting to feel the change of the seasons that is going to be here before we know it? The school buses are showing up this week. It's been chilly and it's been cold in the mornings, and I even started a fire in the fireplace last night. I have noticed a few yellow leaves in my canyon drive from the foothills of Colorado down to Denver, and my horses are even starting to shed their summer coat. It's little bits of hair is coming off of them. It's just all signs that now is the time that seasons are shifting, times are changing, there is change in the air. I invite you to tune into what you're noticing as this new season approaches and what that means for you, for your energy, and for the kinds of projects that you like to dive into. For every season has a different energy, and we each respond differently to the seasons as they approach. So what does the fall season mean for you? What does it bring to you? How does your energy shift? What kinds of things do you like to do when it's fall time? If you tune into that, you can really tune into a different way of showing up and being in your business and being in your work if you're really tuned into what fall means for you. For me, fall always brings a big surge of energy for planning and launching, which is perfect because I'm already deep into creating for all my fall events. I've got Extraordinary Women Connect on September 18th, and my Extraordinary Women Ignite event is on November 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. And if you want to know more about these events, I invite you to just jump out to my website at camigelner.com, and they're both under happenings. But today, I really want to focus in on the flow that is happening with the planning right now for me. I love to teach how to create flow versus push. And I think this is such a perfect example of this. So I want to just take a moment and share this with you. I've had an incredible surge of powerful women saying yes to these events, to being speakers and to being partners on these events. And to them, they're saying yes to the movement of helping women raise up their voice and visibility, to raise up their business, to help others create success. The vision of these events has really spoken to these change maker women who have agreed to join me on this mission. And I couldn't be more thrilled. And I have been in such gratitude for the flow of wisdom and expertise that has been coming my way for these events. I believe I'm getting these big yeses because we're all being called to come together to collaborate. It's an energy of uplifting one another and also lifting up others and sharing of that. We all share this hope for creating impact. And that, my friend, is what really, truly inspires me. And I'm thrilled to be in that flow of it right now. It feels really like I'm in the flow of it. And today's interview with Christine Arguello brings more stories of the importance of raising one another up. Christine is a federal judge of the United States District Court for the District of Colorado, nominated by the President of the United States, and confirmed by the U.S. Senate and appointed for life. Her journey to break barriers as a first-generation high school and college graduate is filled with stories of mentors and others who reached out to help raise her up. At the pinnacle of her career as a judge, Christine makes the space and time to raise up others with her nonprofit law school, Yes, We Can, Si Se Puede, a law school mentoring program. And prior to her presidential appointment to the bench, Judge Arguello's career included partnerships at two private law firms, Holland & Hart and Davis Graham & Stubbs. And she also served as a Chief Deputy Attorney General of Colorado. In our interview, Christine shares that it's our responsibility to reach out and help others climb the next mountain before them. And she shares a stanza from a poem, her very favorite poem, called Success. She shares with us in this interview, to know that one life has breathed easier, this is to have succeeded. My invitation to you, how will you help raise up those around you in the coming months? Make space to ponder this question as we start to embark upon the fall season that will soon be here. Now, let's dig in and let's meet Judge Christine Arguello, another Colorado Women Hall of Fame inductee. Well, welcome to Extraordinary Women Radio, Christine.
Good morning, Cammie. Thank you so much for having me here.
Yeah, you bet. And congratulations on being a Colorado Women's Hall of Fame inductee. What an honor.
It was definitely an honor. I feel very blessed to be in the same realm with all of the other women who have been inducted.
Oh, there's just so many amazing women when you look through the women who have been inducted into the Hall of Fame. It's really incredible, and I'm so blessed to get to interview so many of you. So, thank you for being here today.
You're welcome, and I've really enjoyed listening to the other podcasts.
Oh, good, good, good. So you are a federal court judge nominated by the President of the United States, confirmed by the U.S. Senate, and appointed for life. I mean, wow. Was it your ultimate dream to become a judge?
Well, Cammie, no, it wasn't. You know, I've had a pretty exceptional legal career, mm-hmm. and I am now sitting at the pinnacle of that career as a United States District Court judge.
Sure. But
looking at the path that my career has taken, someone might think that I've been preparing myself to be a judge my entire life, but I am really not that methodical or systematic. Honestly, I didn't even think about becoming a judge until I was 42 years old.
Okay.
I just wanted to be the best trial lawyer I could be.
Okay.
And I didn't realize, I mean, I didn't plan on being the best lawyer in the world, but what I wanted to be was the best lawyer that I could be.
Right.
And so I knew that meant that I just had to put 100% effort into everything I did, and that's what I did. I didn't fit the stereotype at the time. This was back in the late 70s of a trial lawyer. I was only 5 foot tall, mm-hmm. very young and innocent looking, and I was female
tiny.
And Latina.
Yeah.
So I didn't have that persona of a 6 foot tall male who would dominate the courtroom with my physical presence.
Right. Right.
So
what was it about you then? Because I mean, there had to be something really powerful about you that really showed through, right?
I think eventually, yes. And I think actually the greatest asset I had as a trial attorney was that people totally underestimated me because of my physical appearance and the fact that I'm so nice.
Mm-hmm.
But the law firms in Colorado actually kept trying to talk me into doing something else, becoming a transactional attorney. So I had to think really carefully about whether I wanted to go to a law firm that didn't have the confidence in my abilities.
Right.
I didn't want to be stuck in an interior office writing briefs or drafting contracts.
Right.
So I told my husband, I don't think we can go back to Colorado.
Okay.
And at that point, it was like a major decision in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
We gave this grave decision about where to relocate to on the basis of the climate. We were so tired of the Northeast cold. Mm-hmm. We chose two cities out of the blue, San Diego and Miami, merely because of the warmer climate.
Okay.
And I ended up in Miami. The firm that hired me there, Mahoney, Hadlow, and Valdez Fowley, mm-hmm. hired me specifically to join their litigation section.
Okay.
And I will say that it was the best decision I ever made. That firm was the firm that nurtured me, took this diamond in the rough and polished me up and gave me the start that I needed to have to become a trial attorney and the judge that I eventually became.
So you know what I love about this story, Christine, is that, you know, you were hearing, you know, kind of that doubt looking in at you saying, you know, you should go do something different. And you said, you know, you kind of waved your finger and said, oh hell no, we're not going that route. We're going to go, I have a different pathway here and I believe in myself. And you found the right environment in which to have somebody really, you know, helping you raise up where you were and move into that next phase. So, you know, it's just such a good lesson for all of us to think about when, you know, we might hear somebody from the outside saying, oh, do you think you can really do that? Or do you think it's like to turn that volume down there and then to keep on your journey of it.
Right. I just think you need to be tenacious and you should never let someone else dictate what your future is going to be.
Yes. And was there anything from your, you know, just your growing up and your early life that gave you the tenacity to keep moving through that?
Definitely. I don't know if I was just a weird kid or what, but in my family, I was in a, you know, my parents were both Hispanic. My dad was very old school. Uh-huh. Women did the housework. Mm-hmm. Men had total freedom. Mm-hmm. And I was the oldest daughter, even though I had older brothers. So from a young age, the responsibilities of the home got placed on my shoulders to help my mom.
Right.
And I remember resenting the fact that my brothers, who were 4 and 6 years older than me, didn't have to wash dishes, didn't have to clean house. I was the one who had to make their breakfast for them when they got up late on a Saturday. And I remember having these conversations in my head. As I was washing dishes one time, in particular, I remember I was about 7 years old, and I was standing on a chair because I otherwise could not reach the sink. And I was like, God, you know, why did you make me a girl? Why couldn't I be a boy so I could be sitting in there watching Red Skelton with my brothers and my dad?
Right.
And then later, maybe when I was about 9 or 10, this light bulb kind of went on in my head the way, that's sort of how things happen with me. Light bulbs just go on in my head. And I said, you know what? It doesn't matter if I'm a girl. I am going to do what I want to do with my life, and nobody is going to tell me I can't. And it just, I don't know if it's something innate in me, but it was kind of that background that brought it out in me.
Right.
That I said, you don't have to be controlled by your circumstances. You have to follow your parents' rules at this time. So that means you're going to have to do what they say. But when you're 18, you're going to be on your own and you can make your own decisions. And it was from that day forward that I said, I am going to be a career woman. I am going to make enough money to pay someone to clean my house and wash my dishes.
That's right. That's right. That's awesome. And I've heard you describe the secret sauce to your professional success as a lawyer and a judge as including big dreams, hard work, and a lot of serendipity. Hard work, I understand. Can you expound upon further on the big dreams and the serendipity?
Sure. Well, for example, my ultimate dream originally was to become the lawyer and to get my law degree from Harvard Law School.
Right.
And that dream came about, believe it or not, when I was only 13 years old.
Oh, wow. So you knew. I mean, it was like that day at the sink. You knew, okay, I'm doing this.
Well, and it, you know, this is where the serendipity comes in. You know, I happened to have gone to the library when I was 13 years old with a friend of mine. She was talking to the librarian about something, and I was bored. So I picked up a magazine that was left lying on this table. And as I leafed through it, I found this article on lawyers and law schools. And I immediately became fascinated and memorized. And that's the first time in my life that this light bulb had gone on about the fact that I could be something other than a school teacher. And not that being a school teacher is bad. Those were my mentors, and I love teaching kids.
Right.
But, you know, the text of that article conveyed to me the sheer power that lawyers have in accomplishing societal change and to protect individual rights. Now, I had never met a lawyer until I read that article, so it had never occurred to me that I could be a lawyer.
Right.
My simple thinking was, lawyers like to argue with people. I like to argue with people, and I usually win my arguments. So I thought, well, I think I could be a pretty good lawyer. And then the article went on, and it included this picture of Harvard Yard, you know, and I saw the big red brick buildings with the pillars and the iron gates and the buildings covered with green ivy. And, you know, that article concluded by saying Harvard was the best law school, or was considered to be the best law school in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that's what I want. I want the best for myself.
That's
awesome. And so from that day forward, my world was transformed. And that was such a big dream for me. I was a small town girl. My parents hadn't even graduated from high school. I knew nothing about Harvard. I didn't even know where it was located. But I did know that nothing in life is free. And so I figured that in order to accomplish my dream, I was going to have to be willing to pay the price. And that to get into the, quote, best school, I would have to be the, quote, best student. And so from that day forward, it wasn't good enough for me to get merely A's in my classes. I had to have the top grade in all my classes, no matter how hard I had to work to set that curve.
Right.
So that was all quite serendipitous. It was lucky happenstance that I happened to go to the library that day and pick up that magazine. Because if I hadn't read that article,
it was divinely placed in front of you. That would be my...
Well, exactly. But, you know, and sometimes I think, I said, is it serendipity or is this just God's way of pointing me in a certain direction?
Exactly.
And it's because I truly believe that God has a greater plan for all of us.
Oh, I agree.
And I kind of view life as this long hallway with doors on each side. And it's up to you to decide whether you want to try to open that door. And sometimes the doors are locked and sometimes they're open. And then you have to decide if you want to step through.
I love it. I love it. So you had the big dream of being a lawyer. You went down that pathway. How did becoming a federal court judge happen? I mean, what was the circumstances that led to that?
It's a long road. And you know, I never, as I said, I never even thought about becoming a federal court judge until I was 42. Mm-hmm. And that idea was planted in my mind by Judge Bill Downs, who was a federal district court judge up in Wyoming. Okay. He had recently been appointed by President Clinton. He came out to KU where I was teaching law school, trial ad and bankruptcy. And he happened to come by he was at a conference, speaking at a conference there. He came by my office to talk to me about my trial ad program. And as we talked, he just kind of looked at me and said, have you ever thought about being a federal court judge? And I said, oh no, I'm way too young. And he says, well, if you don't mind, you know, can I ask how old you are? And I said, I'm 42. And he said, no, you're perfect then, because they want judges who can sit on that bench for 20 years or more.
Right.
And that was the seed that was planted. So I said, oh, okay, maybe I'll consider that. Well, I moved back to Colorado, and lo and behold, we had some vacancies on the district court here, and my name got sent up, but I didn't get, the president didn't send my name up for the district court, finally. He sent my name up for the 10th Circuit, which is the court above us.
Okay.
Unfortunately for me, it was an election year. And as we see in the news today, they slow down the confirmation hearings for an election year to see, you know, if a new president is going to come in.
Right.
So I never got a hearing.
Okay.
And so then I was a registered Democrat. And when President Bush got elected, I kind of went into what I call the black hole for about 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
Then about the end of President Bush's term, we had 3 vacancies on this court, and we have 7 designated judges, authorized judges. We should have 9 by our caseload, and they were down 3 of the 7. So the judges were really dying. The litigants were upset because they weren't getting their cases heard as expeditiously as possible. And it was my fortune that my former boss, the Attorney General of Colorado, Ken Salazar, was then Senator Salazar.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent my name forward, and Senator Allard sent my name forward. And I had to wait about a year, but then I got my Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, and we were... Phil Brimmer and I, who came on together, were some of the last judges appointed by President Bush. So I have the privilege of having been nominated by both a Democratic president and a Republican president.
Oh, awesome. That's awesome. That's totally awesome. And it's an interesting history lesson for me too, just to understand how, you know, how that works through the system, because I wasn't really tuned into that. So that's really interesting. Thank you for sharing that. So as a federal judge, you've certainly faced some big, important decisions in your career. What have you learned about decision-making, you know, that even comes into life in general?
Right. And that is probably the most important attribute that a judge can have.
Mm-hmm.
Because when people file a lawsuit, they are essentially asking the court or telling the court that they have not been able to resolve the dispute between themselves. And they're mm-hmm. asking me as a judge to step in and help them resolve that dispute.
Right.
So being decisive is an absolute necessity for a judge. Because if you're indecisive, what happens is then no one gets justice because decisions don't get made. And in my mind, it's very true. Justice delayed is justice denied.
Right.
So people often ask me, what's the hardest part of being a judge? And, you know, in terms of decision making, it is having to sentence people who have violated the law, mm-hmm. sentence them to prison.
Right.
Because my decision is going to impact the freedom and liberty of another person.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, I want to be fair to the defendant, but on the other hand, they committed a crime.
Right.
And I have an obligation, you know, to the public and to society to protect them from, you know, these types of crimes. I also need to promote respect for the laws of the United States.
Right.
But I want to, come up with a sentence that is fair, but one that's going to deter that person and others from committing criminal conduct.
Right.
So what do you do? Well, what I do is I spend a lot of time up front. I spend a lot of time preparing. I read the background report on the defendant. I read the facts surrounding the crime. I read the law that applies to the case. And sometimes it's not difficult. You know, right away, this is what would be the right sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it's really difficult because you're looking at sending, you know, mostly their mail that come before me, you know, 20 years in prison.
Mm-hmm. And that changes lives.
That's a long time. It totally is, you know, you have a 21-year-old man who committed a bank robbery.
Right.
And, you know, he's looking at this long sentence because not only did he commit the bank robbery, he used a gun. And if you right. use a gun, it's 7 years tacked on to whatever sentence you have.
Right.
So it's difficult. You spend sleepless nights. You know, I pray to God to give me the wisdom to know what is the right sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And then you walk into court on the day of sentencing. You listen to the arguments of the attorneys. You listen to the allocution of the defendant. And you make your decision. And you impose the sentence that you think is appropriate. And the standard I have to apply on that is a sufficient but not greater than necessary sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So people always ask me, do you second guess your decisions? And my response is no, you cannot second guess yourself.
Right.
Or you will drive yourself crazy
right.
and you will become indecisive, which is the worst thing that could happen to a judge.
Mm-hmm.
So I satisfy myself with knowing that I did my homework up front.
Mm-hmm.
My decision is well thought out. It was informed. It was the best decision I can make. And now it's time to move on to the next matter. Now, saying
good.
That, I do take some solace in the fact that the parties can appeal my decision to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and they have a lower caseload than I do, so they can spend more time, you know, on this, and they have two other judges that they can confer with. And if I make a mistake, they're going to tell me I did.
Yeah, and that's an interesting, you know, humble way to look at that versus just going, well, how dare they, you know, look at this and second guess my decision. But what you're saying there is they have more space and time to look more deeply into it. So that's a really interesting
right.
perspective on that.
Yeah. Now, you know, sometimes people tell me that the job, when I come, this is the hardest part of my job. They say, well, it'll get easier as you get more experience. And my response is that if it ever came to pass that I could make these decisions without really putting all the, you know, effort into it,
mm-hmm.
then that means I've lost that part of my humanity that makes me a good judge, and it will be time for me to leave the bench.
That's really, I like that. Thank you for sharing that. So is it when you apply that to personal life decision making, is it still the do the upfront work? Is that the factor that leads you through personal decision making?
It does. That and then just real open communication with my husband or my kids or whoever it's going to impact. You know, just really thinking it through. But then again, even in my personal life, I'm very decisive. My sister once told me, she says, my gosh, Chris, you just the other day were talking about doing this and now you're doing it. And I said, well, I gave it a lot of thought beforehand. We've discussed it. And once I make a decision, you just move forward.
That's awesome. That's totally awesome. And that's a good thing for all of us to be thinking about, you know, do that upfront homework, but then make the decision and move forward on it and don't second guess it.
Right.
Cool. So you've shattered many glass ceilings over the years, Christine. So what do you attribute your ability to do your breakthroughs through those ceilings?
Well, I think it helps that I'm so old. And I say that somewhat tongue in cheek.
Mm-hmm.
Because honestly, part of me says that the reason I have so many firsts in my resume is that I was really born in an era where women and Hispanics were just starting to enter the professional world
mm-hmm.
and the legal profession in the United States. So I was, in a sense, treading where no Latina had yet tread, and that made it easy to be a first if you were willing to work hard. But I really think what it all boils down to in my case is that, you know, I built a quality reputation. And in order to do that, then I had to be tenacious. I had to persevere. I worked hard. I had great mentors and I built a positive reputation.
Yeah.
And, you know, the first three, tenacity, perseverance, and hard work, you know, I tell young people, especially people of color, that while I believe most people are fair and open-minded, there is discrimination in this world, and life is not always fair.
Right.
There have been many times in my life where I've crossed paths with people who have some authority or position of power over me, and they could impact my career. And these people have prejudged me because of my background, and they've required me to be two or three times better in order to be considered equal to the person sitting next to me.
Right.
And I tell them, you know, you have two choices. You could put your energies into fighting it and get a reputation that you have a chip on your shoulder,
mm-hmm.
or you can just accept it
mm-hmm.
and direct your energies more positively. Just be two times better or three times better.
That's
and
awesome.
Over the course of my life, I've chosen the latter. I worked hard. I was tenacious. I persevered. And as a result, I think I reached more of my full potential than I would have if the road ahead of me had been carpeted and strewn with rose petals.
Absolutely. And you went when, I mean, you would strive for that something, even though, I mean, it was like you were taking those big, bold steps and you were stepping into land that was
uncharted, really.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a really beautiful lesson for all of us.
But then the second point to that is I know that I haven't achieved my successes all on my own.
Mm-hmm.
There
right.
are so many, many people,
right.
and some of them I may not even know, who worked and sacrificed to make it possible for me to succeed.
That's right. None of us get there by ourselves.
Right. And it's not easy sometimes to find a mentor, but no matter what job or position I have ever had, even as a judge at the senior stage of my life, I have always looked around and found a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
An example is when my goal was to make partner at Holland & Hart,
mm-hmm.
I looked around the firm for a partner with whom I had somewhat of a natural rapport, and they were all male back then.
Mm-hmm.
But he also had to be respected and influential enough to help me.
Right.
And he didn't even realize that I had selected him to be my mentor. and what I did is I just sought out work from him.
Right.
And pretty soon I was handling the bulk of the work for his clients, and I took exceptional care of them. I also made sure that he always looked good. When I knew he was going to have lunch with a particular president of the bank, I would send him a short memo saying, this is the status of all the cases, so he looked really good when he talked to them.
Right.
So he helped me to navigate the office politics. He spoke on my behalf in partner meetings. He sang my praises. He deflected what he considered to be unwarranted criticism. And when I came up for partnership, I knew that he was going to fight hard on my behalf because not only did he like me and respect me, but more importantly, if I didn't make partner, he knew that I would leave the firm. And then who was going to take care of his clients?
Right.
So,
right.
And then finally, I think the thing that really everybody needs to keep in mind is that your reputation is the most valuable asset that you possess, period.
Nice.
And you always need to keep in mind that you have only one chance to make a good first impression. So I'm competent. I work hard to learn the subject matter of whatever it is I'm doing. But I also know that my attitude and the way that I treat others
mm-hmm.
is going to have a tremendous impact. I've always treated everyone I encounter, whether it's at work or in the community, as if they are very important people. They are VIPs and they deserve my utmost respect and courtesy because you never know who it is you're going to encounter in life that is going to make or break you. Now, an example of that is that as part of the process of becoming a federal judge,
mm-hmm.
you have to undergo this intense FBI background check and they scour your life. They go back to, you know, college and childhood. And I mean, it's just amazing how much they dig into it.
Mm-hmm.
They want to make sure you don't have any skeletons in your closet and also that you're not going to be a pompous, arrogant judge once you are given that black robe.
Right.
So it was reported back to me by someone that had been interviewed that the agent that interviewed them made this comment. He said, "Is this woman for real? We can't find anyone who has anything negative to say about her." And, you know, that was really reassuring because
you'd
it confirmed
right
that I had
life.
Done exactly.
And you live a good, I mean, that's the standard that you've set for your life. So, that's a beautiful reflection of that.
Yeah. It was very reassuring to hear. It confirmed that I had succeeded in walking the talk.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you've broke through the glass ceilings and, you know, done these breakthroughs, you certainly have come across times in your life where you've had some self-doubt and some fear, some uncertainties. How did you learn to deal with fear and uncertainty and self-doubt? And, you know, how do you break through the discomforts of that?
Okay, well, first, I know that I probably am coming off as sounding very self-confident.
Well, I am
to a certain extent, but you know, mm-hmm. we all have self-doubt and
exactly.
we all have uncertainty about mm-hmm. our ability. And that's just part of being human.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you think you are perfect and there's no room for improvement, then you are not going to develop and grow into a higher level of competency.
Absolutely.
So, for me, it's any time I undertook a new job, and I was always undertaking new jobs, it was a very scary endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess one example that would come to mind is when Ken Salazar was Attorney General and hired me to be the Deputy for State Services, I was essentially going to be supervising 34 lawyers and about 20 support staff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have supervised smaller groups of people, but I'd never supervised a group that large.
Mm-hmm.
And these lawyers had been doing their jobs for years, and I had no clue what their jobs really entailed. So
mm-hmm.
my first question was, how am I going to come in and supervise them if I have not walked in their shoes?
Mm-hmm.
So I actually sat down, thought to myself, if I were in their shoes, what would I want my boss to be like?
Mm-hmm.
My staff, you know, looking at it from that perspective, they had just gotten a new attorney general, so they had a new boss at the very top. They were now getting a new boss at the secondary step, and they were probably very scared.
Right.
They didn't know me.
Mm-hmm.
I figured some might be
coming in.
Right, right. And some might be resentful of me because I was brought in from the outside and they were stepped over for promotion.
Mm-hmm.
They have no clue how I managed. You know, I didn't even know how I intended to manage. In short, they didn't know how life at work for them was going to change because of these changes in their employment.
Right.
So I just figured the first thing I had to do was let them get to know me.
Mm-hmm.
And for me to get to know them. So before I even started working, I called a general staff meeting. I introduced myself to them. I told them a bit about me professionally and personally and how I came to be in this position and what experiences I had in my background that made me a good choice for that position.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was honest with them. I admitted to them that they knew so much more about the work that the section was doing than I did, so I needed to learn from them.
Mm.
And I needed to know what their concerns were about what this change meant to them. I also wanted to get to know them personally, so I would be meeting with them one-on-one, because I really don't think you can be a good manager of people if you don't know who it is that's working for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then I talked to them about my leadership style so they wouldn't be surprised. Then I laid a few ground rules. I told them that there were a few basic rules of conduct, things that I would demand of them. But I also then made a deal with them, and I told them that I would never demand of them anything that I didn't demand of myself.
Right.
And I went through what I've gone through some but here, you know, it was important to me that we all live by the golden rule, which is that you would do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So I did not tolerate disrespect for anyone
mm-hmm.
at all. We were all a team working together
mm-hmm.
and everyone was an important part of that team. And so it was that sort of laying the groundwork. And, you know, at the end result of that was after a year, my section was operating like a well-oiled machine because I didn't interfere with them. I let
right.
them do their work and I helped them do it better. And a year later, Ken Salazar promoted me to be chief deputy, where I was overseeing the entire office, which is now, you know, like 500 employees. but I, having had that success with that group, I just knew that I just had to now expand what I was doing and get to know others and learn from others and
yeah.
let them do, you know, get out of the way, you know, and let them do their jobs.
You know what I love about that is two things. One is that just the vulnerability that you were just, I don't know as much as you know, and you know, but we're here to learn through this together. And then the relationships that you built. And I think that's the, you know, the intent on the on if we approach you know, the fears and the uncertainties in our life with not always being, having to know all the answers and being open to, I don't know all the answers, and to approach it also from a relationship development. You know, let's build solid, real relationships that are respectful, that opens up pathways and doorways to only good things.
Exactly. And you get the most out of your people when you show them that you have that confidence in them. You know, I when I met with them one-on-one, one of the things I would do is I'd say, okay, I don't want you to give me the standard line. You know, when I ask you, where do you see yourself 10 years from now? Don't tell me you just want to be here. Mm-hmm. You know, if you do, then that's fine. But if you have other goals, I want to know them, because part of my role as your supervisor is to help you achieve your goals.
Yeah.
And, you know, so some of them would tell me they wanted to be a judge.
Right.
And I'd say, okay, then we need to make sure that you're doing this and you do this. And, you know, I would talk to them and advise them. And so many of them are now judges.
That's cool.
Knew I was vesting myself in them as well.
Yeah. So on top of all the things you've done, you've also co-founded a nonprofit organization called, it's a law school called Yes We Can, or Si Se Puede. Is that, am I saying that correctly?
Kind of, yeah.
Kind of. So I assume, you know, with every, you know, you are a busy woman. So why were you willing to invest so much time to establish this program?
Well, you know, I think that it is really important that as our country grows more diverse each year, mm-hmm. if we don't have lawmakers that are representative of the diverse communities that are bound by our laws, then people start to doubt, does Lady Justice, you know, perhaps unconsciously mm-hmm. lift her blindfold to favor a privileged few.
Mm-hmm.
So when I thought about that, I said, you know, this is kind of dangerous for society. Our laws are the glue that binds civilization together. And a legal profession that is reflective of the great diversity of our communities, mm-hmm. I believe, is critical to the health of the third branch of government, the judiciary.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a perception of inequity in our justice system, that erodes the fundamental idea that is etched in stone above the United States Supreme Court, our highest court, mm-hmm. that we can all expect equal justice under the law.
Mm-hmm.
So law school, Yes We Can, you know, for years, I guess, before to give some background here, for years, Colorado law firms have lamented that they could not become more diverse because it was hard to attract diverse attorneys to Colorado. Well, I give a lot of inspirational speeches across the state of Colorado to junior high and high school kids. And I know that there are a lot of really great students out there who, you know, have big dreams like I did. Mm-hmm. They have no clue how to get there because right. their parents didn't graduate from high school. They're low income. They have no one to guide them. And I said, you know what? There are these kids out there in Colorado who could become great lawyers if that's what they want, if they have the proper guidance. And so we decided, a handful of lawyers and I sat down and talked about it and said, you know, we're going to start this nonprofit called Law School Yes We Can, Si Se Puede. And we're going to take students who graduate from Colorado high schools because we believe that their ties to Colorado would help keep them here or cause them to return after they obtain their law degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did is essentially we wanted to give them all of the advice that we wish we had had mm-hmm. when we were coming up
mm-hmm.
So that they would be better positioned to get into law school and to then be successful as practicing attorneys. So what we do is we take them in. Generally, it's their freshman year, but we have expanded the program now so they can come in later years of college. But we assign to them three mentors, two lawyers, one who's more than 10 years experience, one that's 10 years or less, and then one law student. And those lawyers have to mentor them throughout the 4 years of their college. And then
awesome.
We add to that workshop programs to develop soft skills like I had no clue what networking was all about and why it was so important. We teach them from freshman year what that's all about.
Right.
We have them we have the admissions directors from both law schools come in and show them what an application to law school looks like when they're freshmen, mm-hmm. so that they know why they need to do internships that don't pay any money. And most of our kids are low income, so it's a big sacrifice on their part. Right. To take on an internship that doesn't pay. And most of them do it, but they also work a second job. It shows them the importance of establishing strong relationships with professors or others in the community so they get good letters of reference. So we are giving them the advice that we wish we had had so we can level that playing field.
Awesome. And where can people learn more about this?
We have our website. It's called lawschoolyeswecan.org.
Okay.
And,
awesome.
And we, you know, so it's any student who is diverse, and our definition of diversity is very broad. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much, anyone who's first generation college, is low income, or has some other obstacle that they've had to overcome, and needs to have that playing field leveled for them.
Awesome.
And
awesome.
You asked why am I willing to spend so much time, in part it's because I do worry about the world that my grandchildren are going to inherit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had a really blessed life,
mm-hmm.
But I know I didn't get to where I am all on my own. I had
right.
a lot of help. I wonder, you know, I've done well for myself,
right.
but I wonder to what further heights I might have flown had I not had to stumble around and find the path on my own sometimes. And so, you know, I believe that if we can give this push to the next generation, they can soar to even greater heights.
Absolutely.
And I
extend
truly,
a hand, right? It's to help.
Exactly. Reach
up.
Back and help them climb that mountain.
Yeah.
And,
absolutely.
You know, we do that by mentoring, by opening doors, by helping to train or network them.
That's awesome.
And, you know, I essentially try to live my life by the last stanza of my favorite poem, which is entitled Success. And it goes, to know that even one life has breathed easier because you have lived. This is to have succeeded. And I truly believe that. And I think that's what makes life worthwhile.
I totally agree. Thank you for sharing that. So the final question that we have for today is, what three pearls of wisdom can you leave our audience today? I know you've given us all sorts of them, but let's kind of, we'll close it up with this.
All right. Well, let me just kind of summarize what I hope I've gotten across is, number one, do not be afraid to dream big.
Mm.
But you have to take control of your own life. You can't let anyone else tell you that you can't accomplish your dreams.
Right. Absolutely.
Second, don't be afraid of change. You know, too many people stay in situations where they're not happy and they're not fulfilled merely because they're afraid of change.
Right.
And in my life, I have never been afraid of change. I actually thrive on change. It energizes me. So my advice would be, don't be afraid to dive off a cliff at least once in your life.
Yes.
But
yes.
Then the third pearl, I guess, would be when you achieve your success, don't be one of those people whom we all know who make it and they never look back or they never hold out a hand to help someone else.
Mm.
It is your responsibility to reach back and do what you can to help others climb that mountain.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that's wonderful. And Christine, it's been such a pleasure to have you here today. I really appreciate it. I appreciate your stories and just the inspiration you shared today. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You bet. You have a good day.
All right. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. I hope you liked this episode of Extraordinary Women Radio. If you did, please share this podcast with your own special tribe of women and help spread the love, the dreams, and the inspiration. Are you thinking about making the next bold move in your life? I invite you to take the Your Next Bold Move quiz at CammieGellner.com to find out how you can jumpstart a passionate and meaningful next chapter. You may also enjoy my book, Fire Dancer, Your Spiral Journey to a Life of Passion and Purpose, which is available on Amazon. In Fire Dancer, you will become intimately connected to your heart's calling and build the courage and resiliency to ignite your what's next. I'd love to hear from you on any of my social media channels. I'm on both Facebook and Twitter, and the links are available on my website. Till next time, my friend, listen to your heart, follow your dreams, and be you.